Today on Conduct Detrimental, Dan Wallach, Mike Lawson, and myself, Dan Lust. What's up, guys?
How you doing, Dan? Mike, good to see you guys again.
How's it going?
A little bit of a busy episode this week. As football season approaches, we wanted to readdress a topic that we've kind of touched on over the last couple months, but certainly has picked up some steam. That's a Deshaun Watson story. Then this kind of peculiar story over in the world of high school football, an area that we've not addressed, Bishop Sycamore. And number three, Dan Wallach, our sports betting guru, is going to cover some of the updates over in Arizona as well as California. But before we get into it, just a quick reminder, this podcast is sponsored by Themis Bar Review. We have a low-cost offer through September 30th. It is $15.95 for anyone who wants to pay in full, and $18.95 if you want to put down a $250 deposit. Listen. Doesn't matter how much Themis Bar Review costs. I'm telling you guys, it's the best bar review prep company. You want to know why? Because they listen to this podcast, okay? We don't worry about any other bar review prep companies in this podcast. We care about Themis. Okay, team, what's going on since we last spoke? Dan, did your wife get mad that I brought up Instagram dogs?
No, I didn't tell her about it. No. We had a great time. You know what we did last night?
What'd you do?
We're in Siberia, Russia, right? We went to see an American movie, which are few and far between in Siberia. You know what just opened here? I think I teased it on Twitter a few weeks ago. Escape from New York, the 1981 film starring Kurt Russell. It finally came to Siberia 40 years after the fact. So it was awesome. It was the first time I saw it. It somehow evaded my radar when I was in college back in the early 80s. Didn't see it. I saw everything else, but I didn't see that film. I highly recommend it. I just want to say you got to look out for Kurt Russell. I predict very big things for Kurt Russell. This young actor, he was really good in Escape from New York. So just keep your eye out for Kurt Russell. He's going to make it.
Dan, Escape from New York, is that a story about your life, that you're just escaping from New York constantly?
I've escaped from a lot of places. It would be Escape from New York, Escape from Long Island, Escape from Queens,
Escape from
Manhattan,
Florida,
Escape from Aventura, Escape from Hallandale Beach,
Escape Florida. From the country of America and to go over to Novosibirsk. Now we need a new one, Dan. Escape from Novosibirsk, Russia. How about that?
I think Escape from Siberia is better on the movie banner. Escape from Novosibirsk, which is a very difficult pronunciation, but I will be back in October.
Okay, Arnold, you will be back. Okay, I'll believe it when I see it. It's been about a year and you still have not returned. Okay, Mike, what's going on in your world? We haven't had you on the podcast in a little bit.
It's been a busy month here for me, still living the first year associate life. So just busy on all fronts, but just taking it in, learning and growing and adapting.
Yeah, Mike, have you been the recipient of the partner giving you a late Friday afternoon assignment that's going to make you work over the weekend? Have you gotten that kind of treatment yet from one of the partners? Just, oh, Mike, you know, can you come by on the way out 3-4 p.m.? Have you gotten one of those blitzes at the last minute before you think you're free for the week?
No, luckily not. But I do work on weekends, but that's just because of my caseload. But well, no, nothing last minute like that.
I'm going to have to speak to Cornelius Murray, my friend Neil Murray, the Daily Fantasy Sports plaintiff's lawyer who has a big oral argument in the New York Court of Appeals next month that could end up bringing down the entire daily fantasy sports structure in New York State. I'll have to ask him to drop by your office late in the day on Friday so you can receive that treatment. That was like the norm for me when I started my career at Weil Gotshal. We worked around the clock and some of these partners were really difficult and it was more the rule rather than the exception. But there were a couple of nice guys, really good partners that I worked for. They weren't all that bad.
Well, luckily for me, Neil doesn't assign me work, but we just go back and forth about the Yankees.
I have a feeling, Dan, you might address that in your What to Watch For, but let us dig into the roadmap. First and foremost, the NFL season is almost upon us, the first game of the season, about a week away as of today. The story kind of looming large over, obviously, the Houston Texans, obviously the NFL, is the Deshaun Watson story. So Deshaun Watson has demanded a trade. Again, you want to believe the reports, this trade has been out there since early in the offseason. Texans' initial ask, first of all, they said he was not on the table. And then they said once he was on the table, you want to believe the reports, 3 first-round picks, 2 second-round picks. You know, the Texans have now said I guess, made him available. The reports that we saw, Charles Robinson at Yahoo Sports reported that there were basically a 4-team sweepstakes to get Deshaun Watson, and the leader in that clubhouse was the Miami Dolphins. And then there was kind of a bargaining, at least as is ongoing right now, again, according to these reports, a lot of bargaining over these pick protections. If they do trade him and he goes to a team, let's say criminal charges come, he's suspended or placed on the commissioner's exempt list, There's an interesting, again, if you want to believe the reports, back and forth behind the scene about negotiating these pick protections. The problem is the NFL still has not made a decision, whether positively or negatively, as to Deshaun Watson's availability for week one of the NFL season. Deshaun Watson is not practicing. He's not taking reps. He's not playing in the preseason. So by all indications, he's going to be a healthy scratch by week one. We'll see if anything changes. I made a point online, and this is how we picked our first topic. We do it very organically. I said I don't really think it's fair what the NFL is doing to the Texans. Of all people, the Texans have to foot the bill, and it's not like the Los Angeles Dodgers and the Trevor Bauer situation where they can replace Trevor Bauer on the roster. Right now, they're burning a roster spot on him, and he's got to be around the team. He's got to be around cameras. So, Dan, I kind of said it. I did an appearance on ESPN Houston. I said it on Houston, and Dan kind of pushed back on me and said that he did not think it was the NFL's obligation to look out for the Texans. So, Dan, I cede the floor to you, my friend. Where do you want to go from here?
Well, I'm going to take the opposite side of it, Dan. I think the NFL is doing a disservice to Deshaun Watson. They're leaving him in limbo, even though they've commenced, you know, the league began their investigation back in April. This is a civil lawsuit. No criminal charges have been brought. There are no police incident reports, to my knowledge. The league has interviewed 10 of the 22 plaintiffs, several of them months ago. We're now almost in month five, approaching month six of an NFL investigation, and now on the precipice of the beginning of the NFL season, the league is now going to maybe put him on the commissioner's exempt list. That would seem to me to be a little bit heavy-handed for a civil case. After they've already investigated him for 6 months, they could have completed this investigation a while ago, even without Watson's participation in the investigation. The purpose of the commissioner's exempt list is to allow the league to conduct, you know, a longer investigation to make a decision. It's a limited and temporary remedy. The problem here is that they began their investigation 6 months ago, or almost 6 months ago. And I think what the league is doing is helping the Texans out by leaving his availability as a possibility for the regular season, because the moment he's on the exempt list, his trade value just goes down precipitously. I don't think an exempt list situation would be helpful for the Houston Texans. And I think if more than anything, the NFL is sort of putting their thumb on the scales to maybe help out the Texans a little bit. And if you ask me, I don't think paid leave here is warranted given how far down the road we are. And this really hurts Deshaun Watson, because now, instead of serving on the exempt list in May, June, the beginning of training camp, his NFL regular season could just become a total washout, hurting him, hurting his new team, and leaving him in a legal limbo.
Now, just to follow up with that, to your point, Dan, you're saying they're doing a disservice to Deshaun, kind of as him being in limbo. How soon should the NFL make this decision if they're going to put him on the exempt list? Because right now, Houston's decision is to keep him on the roster spot, and we don't know if he'll be activated or not. But say he does end up getting traded, and then he gets put on the commissioner's exempt list, the team that he goes to, I feel like, would be absolutely up in arms here, because the reason that that team would probably be going for him in a trade right now is because the NFL has waited so long to put him on that exempt list or not. So how soon do you think that needs to happen before we actually think that Deshaun's going to stay in Houston or go somewhere else?
Sure, it's paid leave. NFL players earn their paychecks on a biweekly basis over a 34 to 36 week period. There was no reason why the NFL had to use, and I'm not preordaining that they've actually made their decision already, but I think most of us, or many of us, expect some type of interim discipline to be levied by the NFL, and it shouldn't be that September 12th or that the first week of the NFL regular season is sort of the alarm flag or the alarm bell for the NFL to decide to place him on the exempt list. That becomes a convenient excuse in order for the league to avoid the negative PR problem. But I have to say here, this is not the Ray Rice kind of situation. When the league has used the exempt list for players who have not been convicted of crimes or even charged with crimes, there have been crimes of violence associated with those, you know, paid leave situations. Adrian Peterson, Ray Rice to a much greater extent. The league had a major PR problem to deal with, and some of these issues were not contested. This is not a crime of violence, although one can debate whether it's a sexual assault or not, but there's civil allegations, no police report, no physical injuries that have been manifested here. This does not strike me, given the totality of the circumstances, as a six-month situation that should just be status quo. And then, you know, at the end of the fifth or sixth month, decide, because it's the beginning of the regular season, now we have to put him on the exempt list. That seems like too convenient of an excuse. And I would argue that the Watson case parts companies significantly from the other situations where the league has used paid leave, where there have been crimes or alleged crimes of violence with much more serious offenses that involve either police investigations or criminal charges. The claims against Deshaun Watson involve none of those.
Dan, you said something really interesting. In this space, sometimes we get it right, sometimes we get it wrong. I think everyone in the sports law space, the second Nike and Beats by Dre, all the sponsors dropped Watson, I think we all kind of said, okay, these companies are protecting their brands. The NFL is probably going to do the same. So I think everybody said he's going to place the commissioner exempt list at some point. The evidence has been placed on the table. We've seen the civil complaints. The NFL is not budging. So I don't necessarily think the season turning from the preseason to week one is going to force the hand if it hasn't already. And Dan, I'm giving you a lot of credit for what you just said. It's a little bit too convenient timing. Somebody asked me, I was on a show today. They said, do you think if they named Deshaun Watson the starter that all of a sudden he'd get a place in the commissioner's exempt list? And I go, I don't know. He's eligible to play tomorrow. So I don't know why that would change anything. The fact that he's going to be playing, I don't necessarily agree with it, but I don't know what would change.
Yeah, but Dan, the NFL could do one thing here to remove the cloud that's hanging over Deshaun Watson's head. They don't have to absolve him from permanent discipline, but they could at least say that we're not going to be placing Deshaun Watson on the NFL commissioner's exempt list. We could have done that months ago. Yes, we're still investigating and we're coming close to wrapping up our investigation, but this has gone on longer than many civil cases right. That have worked on with depositions and discovery. They've interviewed half of the plaintiffs. They've been investigating what are unsworn civil allegations, but they've met with the witnesses and, you know, presumably have conducted enough of an investigation to at least make some type of determination as to whether he should be on the exempt list. The question I ask is, why now? Why not earlier in training camp, and then reach a more rapid conclusion to the investigation and either charge him or not charge him for a violation of the personal conduct policy? This should not take on the lifespan of a commercial litigation, you know, 6 months to 1 year.
Right. So I'm gonna disagree with one thing that you said earlier. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, I don't know what the downside would have been. Like, this is why you have the commissioner's exempt list for a case. It's a really messy allegation, and you have this commissioner's exempt list to pay a guy, and, you know, while the course of the investigation is ongoing, if you didn't put him on the commissioner's exempt list already, if you know, there was a period we were saying, hey, when he reports to camp, they'll put him on the commissioner's exempt list. They didn't do it. We are on the eve of the season. They haven't done it. So there's no new facts and no new evidence that's going to come out. All these complaints have already been out there. I don't think anything's going to change the NFL's mind. So I said, and, you know, I'll hold to this. If you have 20 different women who allegedly have no connection to one another, again, you're just going to go based off what we know. I would think that that's credible evidence, whatever the standards and the NFL standards, obviously not preponderance of the evidence, which is the civil standard or the criminal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. But I would think, you know, if you're going to take it at face value and say that these 20 women don't know each other, I think there would some modicum of truth to this. It's credible evidence. The other alternative, right, is that there is some giant conspiracy with 20 women all banding together to extort Deshaun Watson, and the whole thing is a farce. So I think it's more likely that there's some credible truth to these evidence in their totality than being some giant conspiracy. So all I can say is this, right? There are some staunch defenders of Deshaun Watson that have come out and said that I have no idea what I'm talking about, that Lisa Friel is a genius. And, you know, Lisa Friel and I know some of the same people, and I have all the respect for her in the world. To me right now, it doesn't really make sense what the NFL is doing, unless the NFL knows something that we don't, which is entirely possible. And mind you, I don't think we've spoke about it on this podcast. The FBI is looking into, and this is a report that came from Rusty Hardin, the attorney himself, that one of the alleged victims is being investigated for potential extortion of Deshaun Watson. So maybe that's the smoking gun. Maybe there is some evidence that the NFL has that we don't. But I'm just saying, this just doesn't really seem typical. There's 20 accusers. It's unprecedented. How long are you going to keep the guy in the commissioner's exempt list? These cases are going to go on for a year. So yeah. I don't know. It just seems very odd. I don't know how else to say it. It seems very odd with how the NFL is handling this.
If that was a situation, then that would bode right to what Dan just said. If they had some sort of smoking gun, then they would have already come out and said, we're not going to put him on the exempt list.
Would they? What if something comes out tomorrow and something new comes out? It just seems odd. But if you're still investigating him, why didn't you leave him on? I mean, that's the big question.
Yeah, I want to address your inference or statement that, oh, there are 22 plaintiffs. Well, that creates some kind of inference that maybe there's some merit to some of these cases. I mean, they're just filings of lawsuits. They're not evidence. I mean, I could take a class action lawsuit where I have 20 clients signed up. I could file it as one class action on behalf of all these people similarly situated. But wait a second, under this reasoning, why don't I just create 20 separate lawsuits? And maybe a jury will be much more likely to believe that those lawsuits have merit because I brought so many of them. I think the issue here on the exempt list is, you know, I'm very cynical about how the NFL's disciplinary apparatus works. It wouldn't surprise me in the least, but in fact, I expect Watson to magically end up on this exempt list before the beginning of the season. If he's traded or if he's not traded, I'm of the belief that it's much more likely than not that he will end up there. And the exempt list to me is a form of de facto discipline. He might still be getting his full annual salary, $10.5 million. He's going to get 100 cents on the dollar, but it's not about that for these players. Compensation is just one part of why they play football. You shelve any player in the National Football League, they have a limited time in which to ply their trade. They miss out on their career accomplishments. They fall behind, and missing time is a significant enough penalty to constitute discipline, in my view. And, you know, it's not enough to simply say, okay, you're getting paid your salary, it shouldn't matter. If I was Deshaun Watson and I'm placed on the commissioner's exempt list, I would certainly challenge that with a grievance, especially in light of the fact that the NFL put out that really tactless, you know, video, or, you know, the top 100 players,
right.
You know, tweet or video where there was,
we don't know when Deshaun Watson's going to be on the field, but when he comes back, he's a great player.
Why do you need anything? Just don't say anything.
I mean, that's paragraph number 20. That's paragraph one of my complaint in the Southern District of New York when I filed the lawsuit. If Watson is placed on this list, I know he's getting paid money, but I would say in view of the NFL's predisposition on the outcome of this investigation based on its public comments, I wouldn't just take this, commissioner's exempt list, lying down. I would challenge that. I would challenge that, obviously, through the disciplinary process and then bring an action in federal court. I mean, the league is biased against Deshaun Watson. The fact that the league has not yet taken the exempt list off the table 6 months into an investigation shows the NFL's hand here and suggests that they're really, you know, they're going to impose it arbitrarily, because had it truly been used in the right form, it would have been invoked much earlier on during this investigation, at least earlier in training camp, when he's still being paid, when he's still taking his reps and practicing. To then, you know, to wait and delay it and defer it until the regular season, almost a half a year after the investigation has commenced, seems inequitable and unfair. And in light of the NFL's, you know, statements in other contexts, raises a lot of questions.
I think it's pretty easy, Dan, for me to say, oh, it's a class action lawsuit, there's 20 different lawsuits. I think that loses sight of the standard, right? The totality of the evidence. There's a lot of nuance to how these cases have been brought, right? And you have to look at just how these, what's out there publicly. It's not that these people are faceless, you know, anonymous people as they were at some point. These are 20 plus human beings that have had to put their names attached to these complaints. And it's not just that there's 20 different lawsuits against Deshaun Watson. There are 20 different women who allege strikingly similar allegations. And, you know, mind you, they have the same attorney, who I'm sure probably some commonalities are due to the attorney drafting him. But we have that element, right, that there's 20 women that have accusing him of these massages going awry. And then we have this weird fact that I never forgot, that he had another 20 women that came out in support of him. So Deshaun Watson maybe used 50 massage therapists in the course of a year. Not that normal. It's certainly not that normal. So if you want to tell me there are red flags on the accuser side that they have all the same attorney and there's issues about Tony Busby, but there's issues with Deshaun Watson too. So, I mean, this is the whole point of the commission example. Listen, Dan, I'm with you. If they haven't put him on already, they might not do it. It just seems a little strange. Now, the only part that we haven't talked about that I think is relevant to this whole conversation, the narrative, right? I think Tony Busby won the war in the media war originally. Everyone was talking about these different accusers. I think Rusty Harden's winning it a little bit now, because we're talking about, you know, we're talking about the legal case, but the national media is talking a lot about these trades. So Deshaun Watson's under contract for a couple more years. He's not on a contract year where there's any real need to trade him this year to be able to recoup their value. He also has a no trade clause. So I think Deshaun Watson came out and said, I know the Philadelphia Eagles might want me. I'm not going to the Philadelphia Eagles. He let that be known. So maybe you want to take pennies on the dollar if you're the Houston Texans and make a trade for Deshaun Watson. But Deshaun Watson
has a little bit of the Trump card, right? Because he has a no trade clause. So there is a narrative out there where the Texans hold him for a year, let this thing blow over, and then trade him. But the problem is, Dan, as you and I have spoke, the civil case is going to take more than a year, right? And if there's a criminal case, it's going to stop the civil case in its tracks. And then we're going to have a totally separate track. So that could take more than a year. I don't think the media, the national media, are really aware of how long these cases can really last for in our public conscience.
Yeah. And you know, it's fitting, just as I escape from Florida to go to Siberia, I think it would be fitting as we transition into the next topic that Deshaun Watson does, in fact, get traded to the Miami Dolphins. Because think about it, people who look to change their lives or escape their pasts, so many of them end up in Florida as a second chapter in their lives. So it's only fitting that Deshaun Watson does too. So I would expect him, if the reports from Charles Robinson and Mike Florio have merit, and I believe they do, it looks like he's a future Miami Dolphin. So it's only fitting that he ends up in Florida while I'm stuck here in Siberia.
Well, as we always will do, and thankfully we have a whole team of writers who are ready to jump at the bit. If there's any sort of update on Deshaun Watson, we will definitely keep you up to date with that, especially between, you know, our Twitter, Instagram, and then if there's anything more thorough on our website here. But before we segue into our next topic on Bishop Sycamore, who had a coach who had unlimited ideas for different charter schools who may or may not be real, this podcast is sponsored by Themis, and they have unlimited graded essays. So I think that's probably the best tool that you can use for going into the MEE portion of the bar exam, the essay portion. The more you write, just like our writers for our new website, the more you write, the better you get. So the more essays that you can get graded before the bar, the better. Let's jump into Bishop Sycamore. This kind of jumped at the surface a couple of days ago when Bishop Sycamore had a national televised event on ESPN when they played the IMG Academy, which is the number one football school. They have an insane amount of talent, a lot of top D1 prospects. However, Bishop Sycamore allegedly also had a number of top D1 prospects. Dan, do you want to jump through this? You were all over this on Twitter.
It's just such a fun story. We get stories like this every couple months that are just fun, and everyone's all on the same team and we're all beating up the same person. It's fun. Sports brings people together. So I guess where the story starts, and Mike, you laid it out, and anybody that's listening to this, Bishop Sycamore, you know, you can call them a high school program, but they're full of junior college dropouts. So I don't necessarily know if they're necessarily a high school program, but here's the bullet. So Complex had a story. I know we had an article on the website, which you check out, from Grant Williamson, a lawyer. He's a Tennessee law school alum. There's a great breakdown of this. It's called ESPN's Potential Lawsuit Against Bishop Sycamore. So it's a really crazy story. Here's just some of the high notes. There's allegedly never been a true Bishop Sycamore High School, just kind of floating it out there from Complex. They played 2 games in 3 days. Their head coach currently has an active arrest warrant out for him. And most of the players that I mentioned are junior college dropouts who are nowhere near high school age. So this team of, say, an illegal team that they were not maybe high school appropriate, went in and they played a high school team. They played some younger players. And this was kind of the interesting thing. They got run off the field 58-0 by IMG Academy. Some type of, you know, blue chip players, guys that go into D1 programs. But, you know, you're playing older athletes. You probably, you know, you should be at least competitive. Team got run off the field, and during the ESPN broadcast, there were some kind of weird tones, which people kind of picked up on, that, hey, maybe this team wasn't exactly what we thought it was. So people started digging, and all of a sudden, the story just kind of blew up. So I don't necessarily know. There's so much to it, but I guess people were making Lori Loughlin jokes that she was the director of admissions for Bishop Sycamore because the pseudo didn't exist, that Manti Te'o's girlfriend, Lene, that she also went to Bishop Sycamore, that Cam Newton was going to sign with Bishop Sycamore because he got cut from the Patriots. You know, the Cleveland Guardians were going to change their name to the Bishop Sycamores. So a lot of jokes being made at the Bishop Sycamore's expense. From a legal perspective, this is where I think the story gets kind of fun. Bishop Sycamore, I don't really think they exist. I think you go on their website, which a lot of people did. It doesn't look like a real website. You try to go to the schedule, you can't find the old schedule. It just doesn't seem like a real program. It's a program that's playing games all across the country. They have players that they kind of alleged were of a Division I caliber, which turned out not to be true. And the reports are, and ESPN and another entity called Paragon Sports were kind of duped.
So who is Paragon Sports? Paragon Sports is going to be very important if there is a lawsuit that's filed here. So we took a poll and we said, do you guys want to hear the legal liability analysis? You guys have heard the fun part. Everyone's had fun with the memes, but I think there is potentially a legal case here. Paragon Sports is an entity that ESPN reportedly contracts with to help kind of organize and schedule these showcase high school games. So IMG Academy, people have heard of it. It's, you know, maybe that's even a fake school. I don't know if those guys, how many classes they have, but those are the top high school athletes in the country. This is a professional training facility. Those are the best high school athletes in the country. They go to IMG Academy. So the reports were that nobody really wanted to play IMG Academy in a showcase game and get blown off the field. So Paragon's making a couple phone calls, according to these reports, and somehow they find Bishop Sycamore. I'm not sure how they found him, but Bishop Sycamore says, we have a couple D1 prospects. We're ready to go. We play all these different schools around the country. Paragon says, well, we couldn't really find that much stuff kind of affirming whether this Bishop Sycamore existed or not. But you said, yeah, you know what? What the hell? We'll let him play. Obviously, after the fact, it turns out to be a complete S show. We won't say the curse word. You know, it turns out that Bishop Sycamore kind of duped Paragon, and Paragon kind of made ESPN look bad. So I guess I'll say this, and Mike, I want to give it to you after this because I know that you've found some kind of a defense, someone defending out there Bishop Sycamore. I think the case here, if there would be one, certainly, I haven't seen it, but I imagine Paragon has a contract with ESPN. If they're going to be the marketer, they're arranging these high-level games. I imagine Paragon's going to have some type of contract with ESPN, right? And they have to do their due diligence. And ESPN is trusting Paragon to schedule these games. You know, they're in a role where they have to do their job, or else ESPN could look really bad. And as Grant Williamson points out in his article on Conduct Detrimental, there's certainly reputational and financial harm caused by ESPN to having a school like this whole nonsense, right? You have these big showcase games. You can't have a school coming in, a fake school, and making a mockery of the competition. It does hurt ESPN's brand to some extent. Now, if they have a contractual relationship with Paragon, that's the first one that I think is probably feeling the heat of a potential lawsuit here. Now, how would Bishop Sycamore be involved? I think ESPN would probably bring them into the suit directly, but if they didn't, you know that Paragon would bring them in as a third party, claim to bring them in as a kind of additional defendant to the lawsuit, but vis-a-vis Paragon. I'm not sure who Bishop Sycamore signed some type of release or contract with. It's probably with Paragon. I doubt it would be with ESPN, but it might be. But whoever Bishop Sycamore signed any type of deal with, that's who would likely be bringing them into the lawsuit in terms of that direct privity. And what did Bishop Sycamore do? They committed some type of fraud, some type of material misrepresentation. So certainly Paragon has to do their due diligence. But if an entity lies to them in such a way that, you know, Paragon might not have been able to figure out, yeah, I think Bishop Sycamore could be on the hook. It's not necessarily an assumption of the risk, you know, as I make that joke. Bishop Sycamore can't be out there lying and saying that they have Division I athletes when they don't. And they also can't be saying that, hey, we're a high school team. If we have junior college dropouts, that's not safe from a competition standpoint. So I think that's the case there. Certainly some form of breach of contract, some form of fraud that could be a lawsuit that certainly could be filed here. But Mike, I know that you have somehow uncovered someone that is out here defending Bishop Sycamore.
I'll get to that. And just to your point here, also on that, ESPN also said that they sent originally, you know, complained to Paragon weeks ago because ESPN couldn't learn anything. So Paragon is saying that they had difficulties learning about Bishop Sycamore as well. But ESPN is saying that they weeks ago had told Paragon that they also couldn't learn anything about Bishop Sycamore, their roster, their depth chart, you know, really any information about the school. Because if you go look right now, their website is basically just a blog. It's nothing that would look like a school's website. Also, there was supposed to be a conference call a couple of days before the game with ESPN. So Bishop Sycamore was supposed to be on that, and they allegedly bailed from that conference call, and they provided ESPN a fact sheet of information, which is where you're seeing the reports now, where they claim they had multiple players who had big D1 offers from Power 5 schools. Again, ESPN couldn't verify any of this, and they were trying to rely on Paragon for this, and it didn't work. Now, there's a lot of different threads about this and a lot of different angles, right? We're talking about the potential liability here of Paragon and the potential lawsuit that ESPN could file. But there is the other aspect of the fact that there's this school that doesn't exist or is not a real entity and is playing with athletes who are subpar against IMG, who is number one. However, allegedly, IMG played Bishop Sycamore last year and beat them 56-6.
What was the allegedly in there, that they allegedly played one another?
Well, or
that they allegedly exist?
I don't know if this is a real statistic. I mean, this this is coming
from... We don't know if anything is real, Mike. This could be a beautiful mind at this point. We don't even know if this could all be a figment of our imagination.
Now, this is coming from Max Preps. Last year, their record was 0-6, and they lost by a margin of 227-42. So, like, they got blown out of the water last year as well. Now, the problems that were also arising and what the commentators were saying as the game was going on was that this is unsafe. This is not good. The quarterback was getting banged up. They apparently played 2 days before with the same starting quarterback. These guys played both ways. Their roster was 30 to 35. So it was a lot of safety issues that were coming up. And then like, why is ESPN having this, you know, kind of air on national television? These kids are just getting absolutely demolished. Now, Prep Gridiron Logistic. So Prep Gridiron is a Twitter page that was coming to the defense. And their tweet, which was on August 30th, they said, "I brought these teams together at the request of Paragon ESPN. BS, Bishop Sycamore, has more than one team." So that was that was
Bishop Sycamore's abbreviation is BS?
BS.
This is a problem. Not paying attention here. But go ahead.
So that was, they were saying that there was more than one team. So, which is why they played 2 days before, and then they could play, you know, with a day's rest because they had two different lines, two different teams that they could throw out there. And then they just were really kind of digging in, saying that BS has double digit D1 recruits on their 2021 roster. They fear no one. And they're the only team in Ohio that stepped up and accepted this exciting challenge.
You know what?
Team in America.
I was gonna give you the benefit of the doubt that this Gridiron was some legitimate entity. They feared no one. Okay, they're 0-6 and they've been outscored by 160 points. They got outscored 58-0 by IMG Academy. Congrats, you guys covered the 100-point spread. I am not convinced that the school exists, and I do think, and I guess this is the other part of the story that is relevant, right? This is the big thing, right? Are they a real school, right? And if they are a real school, maybe they shouldn't be. Maybe they shouldn't be if they don't have any accreditation and making the Ohio State School Board kind of look bad. So here was, you know, the coach, Roy Johnson. This is, I thought it was a fantastic headline from the Washington Post. "One person with no regrets, Roy Johnson," quote, "No one has ever heard of us before we got this game." Like, okay, you know, there's a saying, right? All news is good news. Not for if you're Bishop Sycamore. This is all bad news. So Governor Mike DeWine over at Ohio, who said he asked the Ohio Education Department to conduct an investigation into Bishop Sycamore to ensure compliance with Ohio law and to ensure the school is providing educational opportunities that Ohio students deserve. Keep going. Later in today, this is Tuesday we're recording this, Bishop Sycamore has fired Coach Roy Johnson. So I guess not all news is good news, Roy. And then, Mike, you and I were joking. It's almost a situation like we have from Seinfeld, like Cosmo Kramer, right? If the guy doesn't really work there, if it's a fake school, unclear how you can get fired. And then there's that fun element, Mike, that you and I were having fun with, right? Can you have a wrongful termination case against a school that quasi even exists? So it's kind
of
a fun...
How can you get fired if you don't work for a company that exists?
Right. It's so interesting. Like, does the guy even have an employment contract? Who is playing these schools? And Mike, you bring up something really interesting. Like, you know, we're at a certain point, and this is at a certain point that the joke has become reality. This is a school that's closely resembling like Fyre Festival University. They are a joke of a school. And now three schools have canceled games with them. I don't know how this school is going to kind of recover from this. Mind you, every time I Google and anyone there's a report that people have Googled the results, these guys are getting blown out 70-0, 50-0. I don't know who was ever scheduling games against them. And there's the larger question. Why does this program exist? This is a half high school, half junior college team that's playing kind of lower college programs, playing high school programs. Like, what is this, like a travel soccer team? What is the point to having a program that just gets its nose beaten in anytime it plays a game and it has half college kids? I don't understand why this program exists.
Well, here it is. So the head coach, Roy Johnson, is like drowning in debt. He's got a number of lawsuits against him for debt. What was allegedly happening is he was creating a school that was, I don't know, mediocre, or whatever, whoever wanted to play, telling them that they would get an education, whatever. There's quotes now of parents of players being like, "We thought this was real. The players were nice, but the coaches are fake." And then what was happening was Roy was then reaching out to high schools in Maryland and being like, hey, we'll come play you, but we're kind of like low on cash. Pay us to come play you and you can
beat the crap out of them. Oh my God. That's what it is.
They're getting paid to get the crap beat out of them. However, here's the problem. Everyone was like, okay, well, he's taking that money to pay off old loans, right? He's got loans against a bank, whatever. He's got a bunch of different loans that he hasn't paid back yet. He's drowning in debt. No, he was just pocketing the money. So nobody has any idea where he's putting this money.
This is very close to Fyre Festival. I thought people were just making that joke just because the school didn't exist, like the festival didn't exist. If he's taking this money and pocketing it, I mean, that this whole scam makes sense. You go 0-7, just gonna, and I'll just kind of a, just so people don't think Mike's making this up, right? There are a whole world of, like, my legal alma mater, Fordham Law School, is going to play Nebraska this coming weekend. Fordham, I think, is getting paid, if I remember the number. Fordham's getting paid $500,000 to go there and probably lose. But why do you do it? It's a huge payday. And I don't know what the money is in, like, high school. I'm sure it's nowhere near $500,000. But to get on your program, right, and all these kids are playing for high school tape, if you can beat up a team 70-0, right, your quarterback's going to throw 6 touchdowns, going to pad his stats, it might actually help him get a college scholarship. Mike, this is a big scam. I think we're not going to see the end of this. I think it's a really big scam.
And it's crossing numerous state lines here. It's not just in Ohio.
Well, here's the thing. Before we transition, Mike, you know how I bought my Cleveland Guardian shirt? Dan, you know I bought a Cleveland Guardian shirt. Your boy has purchased a Bishop Sycamore shirt soon to be arriving at my house. Guys, anything else to add on Bishop Sycamore before we transition to our third topic? Okay, this topic will now disappear into the abyss, just like Bishop Sycamore. Okay, Dan, you've been awfully quiet over there, and I know what you're doing. You're ramping up your energy. You're taking all this potential energy, and you're about to turn it into kinetic energy. That's the extent of my science knowledge. Because, Dan, we will cede the floor to you. You've told me you have 2 bombs to drop on us, 2 sports betting guru bombs to drop on us, and that is over in Arizona, in California. Dan, I will turn it to you. Enlighten us on the latest in the sports betting world.
Thanks, Dan. I'll try to keep it brief and succinct. There's a lot of ground to cover, and you left out one state, Florida, which saw a whirlwind of activity yesterday. There's been so much happening in the world of legalized sports betting this week. We have sort of flare-ups in 3 different states, Arizona, California, and Florida. Let me lead off with California, which is going to be the largest potential market for sports betting in the United States. Obviously, it's 40 million residents, largest state in the country in terms of population size, 19 professional sports teams. They're also going to lead the nation in constitutional amendments. Yesterday, a coalition led by DraftKings, FanDuel, BetMGM, Bally's, WinBet, Fanatics submitted a petition to the California Secretary of State to create a third ballot question on next year's statewide election. Constitutional amendments get voted on by the electorate at general elections. The next one is November 2022. This measure would create approval for online sports betting throughout California. There's a separate tribal initiative that only allows land-based sports betting. That's going to get voted on and considered next year as well. But DraftKings, FanDuel, and all the online sports betting monoliths now have entered the equation to augment the in-person sports betting that's sponsored by the California tribes to now add online sports betting. So I don't know if you go to California or if you're going to spend any time, but it's going to be awfully confusing if you're a resident of the state having up to 3 different ballot initiatives all touching upon the same question.
That was exactly what I was just going to ask you. Now, it seems like they just keep adding more onto this ballot as a voter. So the differences between it. So you have your initial land base, like you just said, that's already been on the books to be voted on. You have your land base, stereotypical. You go into a physical sports book and then located on tribal territory, correct?
It just qualified for next year's ballot, has not yet been presented to the electorate. It's a year. Right. It's a year away.
Right. Now we have this massive conglomerate of online sports betting to also be voted on. So what do you foresee? If they're voting on both land-based and the online, do you potentially see both happening at the same time, or one kind of debating saying, well, why are we doing this and this at the same time?
Well, it could get confusing for the electorate. I've often heard the expression that when you have more than one ballot question on the same subject, either by design, it's designed to tank both ballot initiatives. You know, it's almost like an assurance of mutual destruction. But I don't think this is the case here, because the ballot question, or the one that was presented by DraftKings and FanDuel yesterday, is intended to be complementary and augment the tribal proposal. It actually fits the jigsaw puzzle and completes sports betting for the entire state of California by adding in a mobile component to complement the tribe's in-person component. And it's very deferential to tribal interests in California. I think the online gaming companies were very sensitive and recognized that they needed to have the tribes as not adversaries, but as, you know, being in alliance or aligned with the online gaming operators' interests. So this petition requires that any online gaming company would have to partner with an Indian tribe. And if the tribes didn't want an online gaming partner and wanted to go it alone, a tribe would be able to apply for its own online sports betting license without using a DraftKings, a FanDuel, or a BetMGM. And the revenues, this is really interesting. Most of the, you know, revenues associated with sports betting go into the state treasury, or it goes to pay, or goes into statewide public education. The revenues associated with sports betting under this proposal are earmarked as follows: 85% to address homelessness and mental health issues, 15% to go into a fund for tribal economic funds. So 15% of the revenues are going to go directly to the tribes, and then the tribes will also benefit in another direct fashion by having partnerships, market access agreements with all the different online gaming operators who, under this initiative, have to partner up with tribes. And for a state the size and magnitude of California, you're talking about state tax collections, or at least a revenue share that would be available to the state of potentially up to $500 million a year. And you're going to be dedicating 85% of that to homelessness. That's a win-win in terms of a PR move to both capture the hearts and minds of the electorate with these good causes, as well as bring the tribes seemingly aboard to your side by having them benefit financially under this arrangement.
I think it's very clear, and I've done it in a couple of steps, and I think you said it very nicely, being the final piece of the puzzle here, all the pieces fitting together. I think they're trying to put together, they're taking kind of pieces from all the other states and learning from the different lawsuits that are popping up, especially with the exclusivity and tribal land versus online sports betting. And I think they're trying to kind of mix it all together and then add in components that go outside the scope of gambling as a whole and helping everything else. So I think one probably lesson that they're taking especially is seeing everything that's popping up with Florida and the Seminole tribe. So can you kind of break down what's happening in Florida now and what's the latest?
Florida, it is now beginning to come to a head. Earlier this month or earlier in August, the Department of the Interior signed off and approve the Seminole Tribes compact with the state of Florida, which grants statewide exclusivity to the Seminole Tribe and allows them to operate mobile sports betting outside of Indian lands. And that's kind of the crux of the problem. I mean, the federal law that allows the states and the tribes to enter into these gaming compacts are limited to only allowing gambling activity to take place on Indian land. And naturally, when you're talking about online or internet sports betting, the customer is located outside of Indian lands. So seizing upon that, I guess, jurisdictional issue or that territorial boundary of the federal law, these two paramutual operators in Florida, Magic City Casino and the Bonita Springs Poker Room, have filed parallel lawsuits, one in Washington, D.C., to challenge the Department of the Interior's approval of the compact. And then they filed a separate suit in Florida to challenge the constitutionality of the statute approving the compact on the basis that it creates a tribal monopoly to the detriment of non-tribal operators. Well, yesterday, the Seminole Tribe struck back and filed a motion to intervene in the Florida lawsuit and separately filed a motion to dismiss the Florida lawsuit for failure to join an indispensable party, namely them. The paramutual plaintiffs only sued the state of Florida. The Seminoles are arguing we're a necessary party, but the twist ending here is that not only have they argued that they're indispensable, but that they can't be sued in any event because they have sovereign immunity. So the relief that they're seeking is the court cannot proceed without the tribe, and the court can't proceed with the tribe either. So therefore, the court must dismiss this lawsuit for failure to state a cause of action, and the court should dismiss it with prejudice without any leave to refile it or renew it, because we can't be sued.
Dan, Florida has always had, we're seeing this, the exclusivity called into question, the exclusivity that the Seminole tribe has in Florida. And a lot of that is coming to the surface now in Arizona too. And I know you're going to break down that. So how do you see this playing out with Florida, and then the difference, what's happening in Arizona with the tribal exclusivity that they have and the adoption of that?
Sure. While the exclusivity arguments, there's some commonality, because most Indian state, you know, gaming compacts have exclusivity provisions. So that's not an anomaly, you know, for the state of Florida. But where Florida differentiates from Arizona is that there's a federal defect in the Florida Seminole Tribes Compact, because it allows gambling to take place off Indian lands through mobile devices. And all of that is under the control of the Seminole tribe under their compacts. Now, states like Arizona, Michigan, and Connecticut allow tribes to operate online sports betting, but they do it outside of the compacting process, outside of federal law, and instead issue licenses to the tribes to operate online sports betting, just like they were racetracks or casinos. Now, that's perfectly permissible. Where Florida, I think, got it wrong, and where it departs company, or where it parts company with those other three states, is the state and the tribe try to shoehorn and sort of squeeze mobile sports betting within the compact. But the compact is governed by federal law, and this federal law, known as the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, only allows gambling activities to take place solely on Indian land and nowhere else. So it raises the question, when you're a customer, you're a bettor, and you place a wager on your mobile device in Disney World, are you on Indian land? And that's the crux of the question in the lawsuits filed in Florida and Washington, D.C. And it's not a case of first impression. It's a case, or it's an issue that has been addressed by other federal courts. But ultimately, two different courts, or at least the one in the District of Columbia, will have to decide whether an online sports bet made by a bettor located outside of tribal lands and received by a server on tribal lands is exclusively conducted within tribal lands, even though the bettor is located somewhere else. That's the core question in Florida. Arizona is a different issue. Arizona has a new sports betting statute, which allocates sports betting licenses, 10 to the professional sports teams, 10 to the Indian tribes. The problem in Arizona is that there are 21 Indian tribes. So there are going to be 10 that get a license, 11 that do not get licenses. And one of those 11 is a disgruntled Indian tribe that wants to have sports betting. And they filed a lawsuit in the Maricopa County Superior Court late last week, challenging Arizona's sports betting statute on constitutional grounds, namely that a state constitutional amendment from the early 2000s granted the tribes exclusivity to all forms of class three gambling, which includes sports betting, in the state of Arizona. And this tribe is seeking to strike down the entire sports betting framework in Arizona on a motion for a preliminary injunction. The hearing is Friday, and I wrote an article for Conduct Detrimental a few days ago in which I did some research, and I discovered that that constitutional amendment from 2002 has language in the remedies provision which contemplates that the state would eventually expand gambling to non-tribal entities outside of tribal land. And in that case, the remedy for the tribe is not a court injunction. It would just simply be the right to reduce the revenue sharing payments made to the state. So the tribal remedy is that they get to pay less money to the state of Arizona, not that they get to strike down and bring down the entire sports betting framework. So that's the key difference between the Florida litigation involving the tribe and the Arizona litigation involving a tribe.
I highly suggest everyone to go to conductdetrimental.com and read Dan's full breakdown of the Arizona situation and his full analysis with what he's describing in the specific section that gives them that monetary remedy. Really, really fascinating stuff. And I definitely suggest going to read Dan's full breakdown.
So at some point, a sponsor, a betting sponsor, will come and they'll sponsor all of that fun knowledge that Dan just dropped for free on the podcast. We don't call him the sports betting guru for nothing.
Tell you who the
all
sponsor
off the top
be.
Of his noggin.
I can tell you who the sponsor won't be. Will not be the Seminole Tribe of Florida. I think we can scratch that one off.
You know what, Dan? If they want to sponsor the podcast, you'll speak very favorably about them. I have a
imagine,
feeling. Right?
Can you imagine? all these months, I was so wrong. I finally saw the light. They were right all along. Where's my check?
So let's, we'll start closing this episode up. We have this fun topic, what to watch for. I will start, as you guys know, I started my New York Law School class a couple weeks back. August 23rd is my first class. I am very much looking forward to it. As you guys both know, I am teaching a specialty class on, it's not this week, we have Labor Day, but the week after that, on September 13th, I have a mock negotiation between the Cleveland Guardians and the Cleveland Guardians. The hypothetical conversation that occurred between, and I'm sure maybe it wasn't even hypothetical, but the Cleveland baseball team representatives and the roller derby representatives. So I'm very much looking forward to continuing to poke the bear that is Cleveland baseball. And I had so much fun today watching all these Bishop Sycamore jokes be tied to the Cleveland Indians. So they were saying, who's running due diligence for ESPN? Is it the Cleveland Indians? And I think it's fair, right? It's the same Googling department, but definitely looking forward to that. Mike, Dan, what do you guys got?
Well, I just want a little shout out to ourselves. Conduct detrimental two times in the news today and two times in the news this week. The article on Arizona sports betting was featured in the Las Vegas Review-Journal, but even bigger than that, the New York Post earlier this morning ran a feature story on what the next steps are for Rachel Nichols. Can she sue ESPN? It's a really deep dive. And I would say about a third of the article is devoted to conduct detrimental. Matt Nettie wrote a piece for us about a week ago on the potential legal liability of ESPN towards Rachel Nichols over the taping issue, because Connecticut and Florida are two-party consent states. And Matt raises the prospect of an invasion of privacy tort and suggested that ESPN would likely be on the hook for significant liability in a hypothetical lawsuit. Kirsten Fleming from the New York Post reached out to me and said, this is a really good piece. Can I interview you? And I said, no, interview Matt Nettie, who wrote it. And he reaped the fruit from that article, and he got significant coverage within Kirsten Fleming's article, which is in today's New York Post. So twice within 1 week, conduct detrimental is cited approvingly in major city daily newspapers.
Well, Dan, before we give it to Mike, I want to give you a shout out, Dan. You did not expect I was about to say this, and don't get nervous. It's a good shout out. All of a sudden, the sleeping giant that is Dan Wallach woke up, and Dan has taken over the sports law news space. All, if you go to the website and you look at the news section on our site, that is not some computer program that is putting in the top breaking news in sports law. That is Dan. And Dan has said on this podcast, I never really knew what you meant by it, that you're 11 hours ahead of us and you get a head start in the day. I now know what you meant by that, because by the time I wake up, Dan, and I have obviously conduct detrimental in my bookmark, I have a whole story, a whole slate of news ready to read. So you know what, Dan, you now supply my news. I thought I was pretty good at looking at Twitter and knowing my notifications. Dan, you make my day. You make my mornings with you. So I want to give you a shout out for that. And then I want to give another shout out to Conduct Detrimental, because Dan, this week, obviously we're in the New York, in the New York papers, you know, we had a shout out, two big shout outs that didn't make it on the podcast last week. Steph Burton wrote a story on Titletown. It's now out on Netflix. It's a Netflix documentary. Steph pointed out that there was maybe some potential NIL issues in a documentary about high school players. And Mike, we joked offline, there might be a documentary about Bishop Sycamore at some point in time. So, you know, it's important to address these issues. The director of the film, of the Netflix documentary series, Titletown, reached out to Steph Burton, and he's now quoted in the article. And then another conduct detrimental contributor, Hannah Valenti, wrote an article about how this, this law firm did this report on the NCAA. And how, as a result, the NCAA was changing the name of the women's basketball tournament to March Madness. Just an interesting issue in terms of men's and women's basketball disparities. And guess what? Hannah Valenti, big shout out to her over at Elon University. Steph Burton's over at Duquesne University, but this one is a shout out to Hannah. She takes her article next level, right? We always talk about different advice here. It's one thing to write an article. It's another thing. Once you've done the work, why don't you go out and promote it, right? It's a win-win for everyone involved. And what did Hannah do? Nobody told her to do this. Hannah, I guess, is a listens to this podcast that Erica Nardini hosts, the CEO of Barstool Sports. And it's a, you know, it's a, I think it's called the Token CEO podcast, something along those lines. But the Barstool CEO has a special Facebook group that's kind of like an invite only, have to be approved admission. So what does Hannah do? She writes this great article, puts this and drops this into the Facebook group, and guess who likes it? We talked about a couple weeks ago when Simone Biles liked the article of Kate Rosenberg over at Law Student at Texas A&M. You know, all of a sudden, you know, Erica Nardini likes a post about, you know, this really interesting issue about men's and women's disparity in college basketball. So here's the thing, right? We don't promise anybody anything on conduct detrimental by publishing, but, you know, people like Matt Nettie writes a great article. It gets on the right radars. Same deal with Steph Burton. Same deal with Hannah Valenti. Same deal with Kate Rosenberg. It keeps happening, right? It's not a coincidence. We are really the only site that's promoting and publishing these original articles in the space and putting people out there. So listen, we don't just say it for lip service. If you want to contribute to the site in a meaningful way, you want to write, just like Grant Williamson, we shouted him out today. He wrote this article about Bishop Sycamore. We will get it to the right people. And we have no problem putting our contributors on a pedestal. We have no egos here. So we're all about pumping up the platform. And if you write something great, we will get this thing out there. John Nucci, big shout out to John Nucci, wrote a great article about how Jake Paul and Tyron Woodley, those guys could have a potential rematch because of a weird tattoo bet they had with one another. Interesting concept of detrimental reliance. I could keep going on. I could keep shouting out people 100 times, but I love the platform. So,
Dan, what you had said, to the point where Dan keeps putting a lot of the latest breaking sports law news on our aggregate, on our news section, you know, that's kind of the goal of Conduct Detrimental, right? We want to have the full encompass, the full sphere of sports law. So we have our original content that we post, and Dan's been shouting them out, and those articles are incredible. But as, you know, somebody who's interested in sports law myself, you know, law students going in, like going to one site to find all of kind of my news for sports law, that's the desirable factor there. You can read about original content, and then we have an aggregate where you can go off to another site and read more about different topics and things like that. So
Mike, it's the only site in the country. It's the only site I know of that curates all the different, you know, sports law, you know, focused, you know, I guess industry news. Could be from ESPN, TMZ Sports. You look at local newspapers, regional papers. It kind of, you know, Greek newspapers. If it involves the intersection of law and sports, I'll find it.
Mike, go ahead with your what to watch for. Send us.
So my what to watch for, way, way back when this story first broke, Evander Kane, I'm still very interested, and that's what my what to watch for is what the NHL is going to do in their investigation of the allegations that he allegedly was throwing games and working with bookies to throw games in a very Pete Rose-esque style situation. But there has been some updates and news in Evander Kane. Recently, we have seen Evander Kane file a temporary restraining order against his wife, Anna. We talked about Anna Kane's Instagram post about her wild allegations, which kind of started, you know, blowing this up with Evander Kane. So he files a temporary restraining order against her because he said that she was abusive towards him and hitting him. Also in news, we have the Chapter 7 bankruptcy, which happened earlier in this year and before all this news came out about him gambling on his own games. There has been movements in that where the approximately $3.3 million house that he owns is now going to be sold as a part of that Chapter 7 bankruptcy. So those are kind of the two quick updates about that, but still no news on the NHL's investigation. So that is definitely what my what to watch for is.
A little birdie, and I'm not going to say the name of a little birdie told me that there is going to be some substantial elements, some updates that we're going to find out in the Evander Kane case. We'll say in the next 10 days, there's some big developments en route. So we will see. I think the issue of credibility is certainly going to be some enlightening facts will come out. I might have said too much, but, you know, all in all, guys, I think it's a really fun episode. Obviously, we're hitting all these different points. The only thing I want to add, at least on my end, and then, you know, I'll cede the floor. Dan Wallach spent a lot of time talking about the sports betting space, and obviously Mike's joining in. If you look at this job board that Matt Haig put on the site, and I don't mean this to be an infomercial for the website. I just think there's a lot of valuable tools out there. We're not going to do a legal life advice, but my legal life advice, if there is one, is just to look at this job board. It is littered with sports betting jobs. Dan is talking, if you listen to Dan, there's hundreds of millions of dollars of sports betting industry, and all that money, a lot of it is being poured into new jobs, right?
It's a new industry with new operators.
Entirely new industry. which needs a lot of staffing. So if you're interested in what Dan is saying on this podcast, the majority of our job postings are in betting compliance. We have 75 postings on the site, always an eternal shout out. And a thank you to Matt Haig, a lawyer over in Chicago who had this idea. But take a look at the job board. We posted again today. What we will have in the next week or two, Taryn is going to be putting together a newsletter, basically like a once a week update. We send out jobs. We send out the top most popular post of the particular week. So, you know, if you're inclined, definitely sign up for the mailing list, newsletter, whatever you want to call it. Just pop on Conduct Detriment. It'll be a little pop-up that greets you, a little friendly greet up right when you get there. I don't have anything else, guys. You have anything else before we put this episode of the books?
Great episode, guys. It was great seeing you, Dan and Mike, and let's do it again next week.
No, thanks for having me back on the episode. I always love jumping on with you guys.
Dan Wallach, as always, is at Wallach Legal. Myself, Dan Lust, at Sports All Us. Mike is at Mike_SonOf_Law, and the show at Condetrimental, the website, conductdetrimental.com. And for all of us here, all of our lovely writers, all of those that have contributed the 130-plus original articles on our website, we will see you next week on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.